Our guest this morning is John Walcott, the co-author of Best Laid Plans. The book was published recently by Harper & Row. Mr. Walcott, hello.
Hello.
I'm very glad that you could be with us this morning.
It's my pleasure.
You begin the book with a very vivid description of the effort to rescue the hostages that had been held in Iran, the Desert One mission. And I think probably by now people are familiar with some of the details and how the helicopters that were sent into the desert ran into some unexpected difficulties. They ran into a sandstorm that caused a lot of mechanical problems. A couple of the helicopters never even made it to the point in the desert. Then they decided, the people in command decided to scrub the mission. As they were trying to leave, one of the helicopters collided with a transport plane. 8 soldiers were killed. It was really a sad outcome. So I think some of the details people will be familiar with. Why was this mission not a success? There seemed to be a lot of small things that went wrong. Was it a combination of small things, or was there some big reason why it was doomed to fail?
Well, at the risk of waffling, David, I think a little of both. There were lots and lots of little things that went wrong, but I think that the reason they did tracks back to some larger reasons. First of all, the military, for all the money that has been spent on it in the last 30 years or so, simply didn't have the tools or the equipment or even the basic structure to carry out a mission like this. This was not the kind of thing the military had prepared itself to do. They'd spent all their time worrying about how to fight the Russians in Germany or the North Koreans in the Korean Peninsula, and had paid very little attention to the problem of what is now called the low-intensity conflict, this kind of small operation in an out-of-the-way place. So they literally didn't have the tools they needed to do this kind of job. The helicopters they used, for example, were totally ill-suited, didn't have the range or the lifting capability for this kind of a mission. Secondly, there was no organization in existence in the military to undertake a mission like this. And so they had to throw together, very late in the day, elements from different services, all of whom, of course, wanted to get a piece of the action. And the result was you had people who had not worked together, had not flown together, having to cooperate under the most difficult kinds of circumstances. For example, you had Marine pilots flying Navy helicopters. And as it happens, the Navy helicopters had rotor blades that were made of a different material than the one that these Marine pilots were accustomed to.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the pilots on the way into Desert One got an indication on his instrument panel that there was a pressure leak. These rotors are literally pressurized. They're hollow and they're pressurized. And this guy had an indication that he had a leak. And that is sort of like seeing the oil pressure light in your car go on. When you see that, boy, you stop immediately. And he did. And he landed the helicopter and couldn't continue. What he didn't know was that there had never been a pressure leak in one of these Navy helicopters, because the rotor blade was made of a different material than what he was used to, and that the odds were enormously in favor of the fact that the instrument was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But he grounded the helicopter, so there you lost 1 out of 8 helicopters right there, because the guy who was flying it really wasn't familiar with its characteristics. And that was typical of the kind of snafus that plagued this mission.
Mm.
And finally, at the end of the day, you had what I guess you'd have to call a massive intelligence failure. And that is that the Central Intelligence Agency had concentrated all of its assets, as they say in the business, in Iran, in the embassy in Tehran, and worse than that, had come to rely very, very heavily on the Shah and his secret police, the Savak, to know what was going on in Iran. And consequently, when the Shah was thrown out and the embassy was captured, they lost everything. So the United States had virtually no intelligence on the ground in Iran that you could use to plan this kind of a mission.
Yeah. It seems that the kind of problems that you cite continue to plague the United States certainly through the Reagan administration and its efforts to deal with terrorism. And it seems that that's a number of commissions and boards of inquiry, and certainly many individuals said all along the way something like, look, we just don't have the material, we don't have the men, we don't have the organization, we just don't have the tools that it takes to deal with this problem. Given that fact, and the fact that people all along said, you know, somehow we've got to get organized, we don't have the right tools, let's go out and get them, why is it that that seemed to continue to be a problem as long as people kept raising it?
Well, I think you're right. I think it continued to be a problem, and I think it's still a problem today. I think if the military had to undertake a rescue mission similar to the Iranian one today, a decade later, I'm not sure it would be any more successful than it was 10 years ago. And one of the reasons, probably the paramount reason for that, is the military doesn't want to do these kinds of things because it isn't convinced that politically they're popular or perhaps even palatable to the Congress or to the American public. And the military, in many ways, I think, is still reeling from the effects of Vietnam. They do not want to do anything that's unpopular. You saw, while he was Defense Secretary, Caspar Weinberger make a number of speeches on that point, arguing that the military practically needed a popular referendum before it would commit its forces to any kind of a dangerous situation around the world. And there's no percentage in this politically for the military to get involved in these kinds of high-risk operations that are not guaranteed to succeed. Secondly, the military doesn't like them because they don't allow it to use, you know, its usual tactic of bringing overwhelming force to bear on a problem. I mean, if you look at the history of the American military, I think what you find is that it tends not to win with finesse, but it tends to win with sheer force. Carpet bombing North Vietnam, that didn't win. But that was the top. That was the tactic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's used sheer force. Certainly in World War II, the arsenal of democracy was what finally turned the tide. Sheer numbers of airplanes. That's not to say that the fighting man is unimportant, or that he's not courageous, or that he doesn't perform well. But the American military likes to apply overwhelming force, as it did most recently 5 years ago. We're now, I guess the administration is trying to celebrate the anniversary of Grenada. And that was a classic example of the kind of thing the military does like to do. Let's use a huge amount of force against a little tiny target so the outcome is never in doubt and so the risk isn't very great. And when you try to mount this kind of a surgical operation, and keep it quiet, make it virtually invisible, make it secret, until the last minute, you can't use that kind of overwhelming force.
Mm-hmm.
The minute you start moving huge numbers of men and airplanes around, somebody's going to notice it. So they simply don't want to do these kinds of things, never have, and they have dragged their feet for years. Most recently, there's some people in Congress, Senator Cohen from Maine among them, who have been trying to prod the military into creating some more versatile, flexible, smaller forces. They just don't want to do it.
Hmm. It seems also the case that one thing that you see in many career military people who've been in for a long time is they tend to be rather inflexible and bound by tradition. They're tempted to say, well, look, we're going to do it this way because we've always done it this way. And in an operation against some small group of terrorists, this kind of surgical operation that you describe, often you have to do things in a very unconventional way. You have to do things in a way that nobody has ever done them before, and the military is just, they're just not used to thinking that way.
I think that's right. Like most big bureaucracies, innovation and unconventional thinking tends not to be the fastest way to the top. That's as true in the military, more true maybe in the military than it is in your average bank or manufacturing company. The guy who's out of line, who's out of step, who's saying, well, gee, you know, we never did it this way, let's try it, is usually not the guy who becomes the CEO of the operation. Now, there's another thing that's happened in the military, and that is the fascination with technology. Sometimes it's possible to sell a new idea in the military, like the president's Star Wars missile defense program, if it has a heavy dose of real fancy technology in it. If you can get all the weapons labs involved and spend billions of dollars on widgets and gizmos and framistams. But the fighting terrorism doesn't buy you that either, because you can't fight terrorists with gizmos and framistams. So you can't get all the weapons labs involved. You can't get all the corporate interests involved, you know, who want to sell things to the Pentagon. There's no money in it either. So the politics are lousy and the economics are lousy. And then finally, just as you say, the military has never been particularly famous for innovative thinking. One of the things we point out kind of in passing in the book, because frankly I found it interesting, is how far that is from the tradition of the American military where it began in the American Revolution, fighting in very unconventional ways. And, as a matter of fact, the British constantly were complaining that the Americans, that the colonists didn't fight fair, that they hid behind rocks and fought like Indians and so on. That tradition has been almost totally lost, it seems to me, except among a handful of junior officers.
This morning on Focus 580, John Walcott is our guest. He's co-author of the book Best Laid Plans, The Inside Story of America's War Against Terrorism. He's national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We're talking this morning about American efforts to deal with terrorism. And if you have questions or thoughts of your own, 333-9455, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. From the moment the Reagan administration took over, and in fact, even before President Reagan was inaugurated, the decision had been made to make dealing with terrorism a high priority, a very high priority. Why was that? Why was it that terrorism was so important to the president and his advisors?
I think two things. One is they saw that terrorism really had helped do in Jimmy Carter. That Carter's inability to get those hostages out of the embassy in Tehran had driven home the image of Jimmy Carter as a weak and ineffective president. It was one of the things, in other words, that helped catapult Ronald Reagan into the presidency. And the people around him, and perhaps the president himself, wanted to make darn sure that the same thing didn't happen to them, that they could succeed where Jimmy Carter failed. Remember that a central theme of the president's campaign in 1980 was the restoration of American strength and leadership. That the United States would no longer be perceived around the world as weak. And what better way to demonstrate that but than by succeeding where Jimmy Carter had failed? And that was in dealing with terrorism. But beyond that, I think, you know, as Dave Martin and I put this book together, some other more subtle things came to the surface. The most interesting of which to me, David, was the constant tendency of people high up in the administration, Secretary of State Haig being one of them and the late CIA director William Casey being another, to confuse terrorism and communism, to believe that terrorism was a tool of some kind of an international communist conspiracy, and that everywhere you saw terrorists, behind them there was a Soviet puppet master. So, for example, when they looked at Libya, and there's some, I think, rather interesting documentation in the book about Haig writing things in the margins of memos that his own intelligence people had sent to him. They'd send him memos saying, you know, Mr. Secretary, there is all kinds of Soviet military hardware in Libya, but that's just because Gaddafi has too much money and not enough brains. And Haig would write back, you're crazy, these are really Soviet bases, and they're planning to use it, you know, if they need to attack Italy or Greece, the southern flank of NATO, in a general war. And nobody in the State Department believed that. None of the experts did. But every time they sent Haig a memo arguing their case, he would send it back with a note handwritten on it saying, you're nuts, you've been brainwashed if you believe this, and so on. So there was a tendency at the high level in the CIA, also in the State Department, and I think also in the White House, to believe that terrorism was just another one of Moscow's tools in the great global warfare, which, after all, was the foreign policy preoccupation of the Reagan administration, especially in its first term. Times have changed now since Gorbachev, and I think we've forgotten the confrontational mood that prevailed in the early 80s. But this was certainly part of it. And that all of those things combined, I think, to make terrorism much more important in Ronald Reagan's mind, in the mind of the administration, than it ever was in fact.
Another thing that happened very early in the administration was Libya was identified as a prime target for action. Why was it that Libya was singled out?
Well, look, first of all, to be fair, Libya was singled out because it deserved to be singled out. There are still, I think, a lot of revisionist historians who try to argue the case that, that Muammar Gaddafi is really not such a bad guy. And I've got to say that the preponderance, overwhelming preponderance of evidence, indicates that Muammar Gaddafi sponsors terrorism. He tried to assassinate the American ambassador to Egypt at one point. He has helped subsidize the Irish Republican Army with huge shipments of weapons. He's a bad guy who meddles as far and as often as he can, and who does not shirk from occasionally trying to deal blows to the United States, to kill Americans, or to sponsor groups that like to kill Americans, like the Palestinian terrorist Abu Nidal. So it's not simply a matter of Washington sort of spinning a globe the way you'd spin a roulette wheel and sticking a finger down where it stopped and saying, ah, well, let's go after Libya. Gaddafi had a bad habit of doing a lot of nasty things, and worse yet, of then bragging about them, and saying, look what a naughty boy I was. All over the world. So that's the first point. But I think beyond that, we're now asking whether he was really as important a troublemaker as the Reagan administration made him out to be. Troublemaker, yes. Was he really a global rival of the United States, a threat to the national security of the United States? No, of course not. But he was a very attractive target, basically because nobody else liked him either. You could pick on Gaddafi all you wanted. You could even attack him, and nobody would come to his defense. Not his friends in Moscow, not his supposed friends in the rest of the Arab world or in Africa. He was such a bad boy that he really didn't have very many friends. His military wasn't particularly strong. Geographically, he was easy to attack because all the worthwhile targets are neatly lined up along the Libyan coast, so they're very easy to get to without too much risk. And again, it became a convenient way to make the point, I think, that the United States was back and standing tall and wasn't going to take any of this nonsense from characters like Muammar Gaddafi with their anti-American rhetoric and hit squads running hither and thither, both real and imagined.
The first kind of hostage crisis that the Reagan administration had to deal with was when the Italian terrorists, the Red Brigades, kidnapped General Dozier, who was a NATO officer, not a particularly highly placed one, but one who was in Italy. There's some amazing stories about the kinds of things that were done to try to find out where he was being held, including the use of psychics. And finally, in spite of all of this psychic effort, the Italians managed to find and rescue General Dozier. But it seems that here's a case that points up some of the worst communication problems and bureaucratic infighting between various competing interest groups in the military and the intelligence communities that we have had, but also it's something that seems to have plagued our efforts to deal with terrorism all along. That is, people struggling. It was turf battles, really, and that seemed to happen a lot.
No, that's right. The worst thing about the Dozier case, though, I think, was that nobody learned anything from it. That the real lesson of the Dozier case was that the best way to deal with terrorists is with good police work, which is how the Italians eventually cracked the case and rescued the guy. It's just old-fashioned police work, the same thing, on a not much more glamorous scale than the police in Champaign, Illinois have to do day in and day out, or in any other city. Running down suspects, trying to get people to talk, etc. And so while the United States was running hither, thither, and yon and bringing in psychics who said he was being held at the bottom of a pond, issuing Delphic pronouncements that he was being held in the place of the shepherds, whatever that meant, etc., and trying to use all sorts of, again, of fancy technology and whiz-bangs and gizmos, the Italian cops were out pounding the beat. eventually found a relative of somebody in this particular Red Brigade cell and cracked the case. But nobody here seemed to have learned anything from that. The United States persisted for years in continuing to try to bring in the equivalent of psychics to fight terrorism that way. And only after the collapse of the Iran scandal and all of the disgrace that that brought, got around to the business of recognizing that, yeah, terrorism really, at the end of the day, is a criminal problem and is best dealt with that way.
The most in terms of a number of people killed, the most damaging terrorist incident during the Reagan term was when the 240 Marines were killed by a truck bomb in Beirut, Lebanon. This came just a matter of months after a similar bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. And I guess afterwards, perhaps it's easy to do that afterwards, a lot of people said that the Marine emplacement should have been prepared for this kind of attack. It should have been better defended, that there were even some hints that that we had some idea that that attack was going to happen. Maybe we didn't know precisely when it was going to happen, but that we had some idea. Should the United States have anticipated that attack on the Marines, especially after the attack on the embassy?
Of course. I mean, not only had the American embassy been attacked, but the Iraqi embassy had been car bombed in a very similar fashion. Car bombs had gone off elsewhere. There had been a pattern of using that kind of weapon, in some cases suicidally. So, yeah, of course. What happened in Lebanon, and there are two chapters in Best Laid Plans devoted to it, and I suppose I'm a little bit prejudiced, but I think in many ways they're the most important two chapters in the entire book. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think we've really come to grips with what went wrong there and why so many Americans lost either their lives or their freedom, some of them still being held hostage. How good intentions got translated into such a terrible debacle. And it took two chapters of the book to unravel that. A lot of new revelations, new discoveries about what really went wrong. But in the case of the Marines, I think basically you had politics interfering with the military's ability to do its job. You had orders given for political reasons. For example, soldiers who were asked to keep the chambers in their weapons unloaded, to minimize the risk of accidentally shooting an innocent civilian and consequently stirring up a ruckus in Congress. Marines concentrated in an absolutely awful position at the Beirut airport, which is down in a flat section next to the beach, surrounded by mountains on one side and by the slums, an absolute rabbit warren of little houses on the north side. Absolutely terribly vulnerable position that no military commander would ever pick for his people. But the Marines were put there and kept there for political reasons. Again, not to intrude too much, not to make the mission too risky or too big. And they were left, in other words, as sitting ducks by the policymakers in Washington for political reasons. And 241 of them just 5 years ago this month lost their lives. And I think it's frankly damned important that people go back and read what really happened, so that it never, ever happens again.
There was talk after this of some kind of retaliation. Why wasn't there any retaliation? Did we know, did we have a good enough idea who's responsible so we could have retaliated?
Yes. There was very little question, frankly, that ultimately the Iranians were behind this, that they'd been running their terrorist network, at that time fledgling terrorist network in Lebanon, through their embassy in Syria. The ambassador then, who we identify in the book, is now the interior minister in Iran. So he was promoted for his good work in blowing up Americans in Lebanon and taking them hostage. And the money for the attack, probably the explosives as well, were provided by the Iranians. And the training for the groups that did it was provided by the Iranians. They finally this year actually confessed that, said, yeah, we trained the guy who blew up the Marines. And their headquarters in Lebanon was very, very well known, even at the time. It was a place called the Sheikh Abdullah Barracks, which is in the Bekaa Valley of eastern Lebanon. And immediately after the bombing, there were plans put together to retaliate. And I'll tell you what happened. There was a plan put together to retaliate in concert with the French, who had also lost a number of paratroopers to a car bomb attack that very same day in October 1983. And the plan was put together for carrier-based planes, French and American, to strike this Sheikh Abdullah Barracks, the terrorist headquarters in Lebanon. And when the morning came for it to happen, the National Security Advisor, then Robert McFarland, came into his office very early in the morning, and his deputy, the later famous John Poindexter, said to him, I don't think it's going to happen. And McFarland said, what do you mean it's not going to happen? I mean, we agreed on this. And Poindexter said, well, the Pentagon doesn't want to do it. And so McFarland called up then-Defense Secretary Weinberger and said, basically, what the hell's going on here? And Weinberger hemmed and hawed and said, well, you know, we haven't had enough time. We haven't coordinated it well enough with the French. And finally said, we don't know who's up there. You know, maybe the terrorists were there, but who's there now? And finally said, I just don't think it's prudent. And refused to do it. And McFarland did the only thing he could do, which was to turn to the president. And in effect say, Mr. President, what's going on here? I mean, I thought you had decided what we were going to do, and now the defense secretary has decided he doesn't want to do it. And the president's response was to ball his hand up into a fist and hit his desk and say, damn, I sure wish we could do it. And it never happened. The French went and did it alone, and as it happened, missed everything. Missed the barracks completely. Hit absolutely nothing. But throughout the book, you'll see a pattern of the Pentagon, going back to what we were saying earlier, the Pentagon absolutely refusing to take action, not wanting to do anything. And here you had, I think, the clearest evidence, at least the clearest anecdotal evidence, that Ronald Reagan was a weak president, that contrary to the image he tried to project of strength, that he was unable to resolve the differences within his own cabinet. And there's a very telling quote in the book, and going back to something you were saying before I came on the line here, all of the quotes in the book are on the record. Mm-hmm. There's not a single anonymous quote in this book. So none of these senior officials and, you know, high-ranking White House staffers, everybody who's quoted is quoted by name. And there is a quote from a fellow named Howard Teicher, who worked on the National Security Council staff, saying that he thinks history will judge Ronald Reagan as a weak and ineffective president. And I think coming from a member of the president's own staff, that's a pretty damning commentary. But I think it's one that's generally supported by the facts.
Yeah. We're talking this morning about the United States and its efforts to deal with terrorism, and our guest is John Walcott. This morning on Focus 580, we're talking with John Walcott. He is the national security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. He and David C. Martin, who is a CBS Pentagon correspondent, have worked together on a book. The title is The Best Laid Plans, The Inside Story of America's War Against Terrorism. The book is published by Harper & Row and has come out fairly recently. If you have some questions on some of the things that we have discussed to this point in the program, or if you'd like to raise something new, please do pick up your phone and give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere in the state of Illinois. That's 800-222-9455. We were talking about the attack on the Marines in Beirut, and you also mentioned the hostages, the American hostages that are being held in Beirut. The first person, I think, was kidnapped there in 82, and then after that, there were a number of other people who had been taken hostage. Some of those people were released. Some are still being held. At one point, wasn't someone considering a rescue mission to go after those people?
Oh, several times. Several times. You'll find, you know, in reading the book that there were a couple of times when people thought they might have a chance. basically every time a hostage got out, they pre-positioned some rescue forces in the hopes that whoever got out would be able to tell them where the others were being held. And then there was a point later on in the summer of 1986 when the CIA got a report that all the hostages were being held in the basement of an old prison in Beirut and spent $30,000 building a model of the prison to help the commandos storm it. And, of course, that, too, didn't pan out. So, there were lots of preparations made. People always had an eye on trying to do something. But, again, the intelligence was never there to support any kind of rescue mission.
Mm-hmm.
And, on one occasion, it's sort of typical. There was a hostage named Jeremy Levin, who was a correspondent for Cable News Network, who managed to get free in February of 1985 and escaped and, very heroically tried to go back and show people where he'd been held and couldn't because he didn't have his glasses. But nevertheless, they were able to deduce from what Levin told them that the hostages had been held in some houses just outside this famous Sheikh Abdullah barracks I was talking about a minute ago. And McFarlane and some others pushed very hard at that time for a rescue mission. But I think it's interesting to note that had they tried it, they would have failed because the hostages were moved the very night that Levin escaped. The captors realized the jeopardy they might be in and moved the hostages out, separated them so they were no longer held in one place and no longer held at the barracks. So what would have happened had that rescue mission gone ahead? It would have been a replay of a famous one at the San Tay prison camp in Vietnam when a rescue force arrived and found the prison empty. So it wouldn't have worked. And lots of preparations were made. A lot of thought was given to it. A lot of money was spent on it. But the fact is no one ever knew where the hostages were well enough to stage any kind of rescue mission.
Wasn't there at one point where the Central Intelligence Agency thought they had a plan and they thought that they knew they had a location where there were at least three people being held, but it was not implemented in that case because Oliver North came along and said, well, he thought maybe he had a better way. And it turned out to be that he was thinking about the exchange of arms for the hostages.
Well, North's scheme, when it really got rolling, never really put the brakes on any rescue mission.
Mm-hmm.
What it did, unfortunately, was to put the brakes on every sensible attempt to deal with the problem. And I think, frankly, that what happened was that the value of that arms for hostages deal to the Contras was so great that North, it essentially became self-sustaining. It became more important than getting the hostages out was, unfortunately, for North. I mean, and consequently, he lost sight of his original objective once he discovered this new source of money for the Contra program. And during that time, virtually all of the energy that the government expended on the hostage problem went into the arms for hostages deal. So it's a case, I guess, of Gresham's Law revisited, of bad ideas driving out good ones.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that it is easy for someone who is on the outside to be critical of some of our efforts to deal with terrorism. And I wonder if in fairness, you have to pose the question, if in some of these cases where someone has committed a terrorist act, if it is so difficult to identify who committed the act or where they are, should we be surprised that it's so difficult to do anything about it? When you're dealing with terrorists where you have perhaps small groups of people, they may be very mobile, they may be places in which it's very difficult for our people to operate, to gather intelligence. It may be that, as in the case of the attempt to rescue the hostages under the Carter administration, just physically it was a long way to go. There were a lot of difficulties. Should we expect that something this difficult is also going? Shouldn't we expect that it's also going to be extremely difficult?
No, I think that's right. And I'll tell you, somebody who is looking for a hatchet job on the Reagan administration or the military or anything else shouldn't bother to waste his money on this book, because best laid plans is not a hatchet job at all. As a matter of fact, we've been criticized in some reviews, I'll tell you very honestly, because we didn't do a hatchet job. We've been accused of being soft on the military, of being soft on this and soft on that. Let me just read you from the preface of the book, where we're coming from mm-hmm. on that, so people know. What we've said in part here is that tracking back over these events has been an exercise in humility, a revelation of how much we missed or got wrong the first time around. We tried to keep that lesson in mind when it came to judging the protagonists in these events, those who played the game while we looked on from the safety and comfort of the sidelines. They, too, were experiencing these events for the first time, usually well bent under the weight of workloads that would crush most of us. No, I don't think there are any easy answers. And, you know, certainly there are no easy answers at the end of this book when we come around to trying to analyze the best way to deal with the problem for ourselves. These are very, very difficult things. I think the main criticism we have is, frankly, that the administration made this problem in public particularly far too important, that it made such a big deal out of things that it made it harder to deal with. For example, I think one of the reasons you're seeing such a wave of hostage fever right now with people trying to exploit the situation to make money or whatever is because the administration sent the signal years ago that it was willing to pay to get hostages back. And that, you know, we're willing to wheel and deal and even stand our own foreign policy on its head in order to get the hostages back. And I think that's encouraged, you know, every brand of sleazeball, frankly, to think, gee, if he can get a hold of a picture of a few hostages, he can sell it for something. And it's very hard to be stoic about the problem. It's very hard for the President of the United States to meet with the families of these hostages and to tell them that there's nothing he can do, that he can't subvert the foreign policy of the United States to the well-being of one or two or 10 or even 100 American citizens. But unfortunately, that's what has to be done. And when it isn't done, when the signal that's sent is one of desperation or, as I say, willingness to pay a price, almost any price, then you get into deep, deep trouble.
After the Iran-Contra revelations came out, one of the things that President Reagan tried to do was to minimize this appearance that what we were in fact doing was trading arms for hostages, that we were in fact paying somebody to get the hostages back. And he made some rather odd statements where in one sentence he said that we didn't do it, in the next sentence he said that we did. Just whose decision was it, and at what level was that decision made, or do we know?
That's a good question. But again, you really find what we found and what some other recent books have found is really a vacuum at the top of this administration. I mean, I think what happened, and again, we've put the Iran-Contra, the two chapters on that together in a way in the book that I think will give people a completely different look than they've ever had at what happened. First of all, we've tried to tell them what was going on with the hostages, what their lives were like, what it's like to be a hostage in Lebanon. So you can see the kind of emotion that drove all these ridiculous attempts to get them out. And in fairness, I think you have to try to walk a mile in the president's moccasins or whatever. So we've tried to lay that out, but secondly, secondly, what we found is that it's very hard to find Ronald Reagan's fingerprints anywhere in this. It's hard to find a place where he made a difference. But in the case of the decision to sell arms to Iran, it's quite clear that he went along with it, and he went along with it to trade arms for hostages, not for some other high-flying foreign policy reason, not because he wanted to strike some kind of an accommodation with moderates in Iran. That's nonsense. The fact is that the president, having met with the families of these hostages, having reacted in a perfectly human and in some ways admirable way, wanted to get those hostages out. People came to him, people with a lousy judgment, and said, here's the way to do it. And he said, fine, we got to do something, go do it. And he's responsible for approving what, from the start, was an arms for hostages deal. No matter what he says in his first sentence or his second sentence or his third sentence or his eighth press conference, because his explanations have varied all over the lot. He approved trading arms for hostages. There's just no other way to, no other conclusion you can reach from looking over the facts.
Well, I wonder, that makes one wonder that if you're dealing with people who are holding hostages, whether the most realistic thing that you can do, although it's humanly maybe almost impossible, is to go into it thinking to yourself that the hostages are dead. If by some miracle we manage to get them back alive, well, maybe that's an act of God or whatever, but that for all practical purposes, these people are not coming back.
It actually would be a less cruel way of looking at it. But what happens is that, the captors keep trying to keep that issue alive. They keep releasing photographs. They keep releasing videotapes. They keep releasing statements to prove that the hostages are alive. These guys aren't stupid, the guys who are holding the hostages. They're cruel. There are any number of other things. They are not stupid. They have goods they want to sell. The various groups holding hostages have various prices they want for them. But they all want to sell their goods for something. And they want to drive the price up as high as they can. So they've gotten fairly skillful. And we're seeing it again this fall with remarkable frequency. The photographs showing up, the letters, the statements, etc. to try to keep this issue alive, because I think right now they figure that it's a seller's market. Mm-hmm. With a presidential election coming and all of the uncertainties beyond that in American politics, a lot of uncertainties in Iranian politics, a lot of uncertainties in Lebanon. This is a good time for them to sell. They figure they can get the best price. So they keep doing this. And worse than that, what you've got going on is a lot of people trying to make a buck off this issue, going to the families of the hostages and saying, I can get your husband out.
You mean
if only you can get the government to give me $1 million.
Mercenary types?
Absolutely. Crooks, a lot of them. We just had this strange tale that hasn't been unraveled yet of the woman showing up in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
With the photographs and all. But let me again read you a passage which I think tells you this is nothing new. This is a quote from Claire George, who was the deputy director of the CIA for intelligence. He says, beginning in 1984, when the great burst of early hostages were taken, we began to receive feelers. It is a brutal, ugly story, but people were selling information, selling hostages, selling their rings, selling their clothes, selling letters from them, trying to make money out of the hostage business. And that's been going on ever since. And some of these guys, some of these sleazeballs, will come to the families, as I say, and play on the obvious emotions of people who want to see their loved ones again, who aren't willing to let go of their loved ones.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons, and trying to exploit it.
We have 6 or 7 minutes left, and I have a caller here who would like to talk with us. Our guest this morning, John Walcott, reporter for The Wall Street Journal and co-author of the book Best Laid Plans, The Inside Story of America's War Against Terrorism. We do have time for a couple of questions if you'd like to talk with our guest. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I'm thinking about terrorism worldwide and seeing what happens in Northern Ireland, where Margaret Thatcher has decided that the way to solve terrorism is, a more heavy-handed situation. Or in South Africa, we're trying to control terrorism, stricter laws and that type of thing. And I'm wondering about before the 1980 election, doesn't it seem to me that Reagan was using a lot of buzzwords, humiliation, shame, the strength of America, and how Carter had, almost personally embarrassed us and everything by allowing these hostages. And for months after that, everything was Jimmy Carter's fault. If there was anything wrong in the CIA, it was Jimmy Carter's fault. And I think the American people are not prepared for the difficulties in dealing with terrorism. And I think a lot of it really was some of Reagan's rhetoric. I mean, some of it was terrible. I'd like your reaction to that.
Well, I'll tell you an anecdote from the book, which I think makes your point. I agree with you. Right off the top. One of the first things the president did, literally within a week of being sworn into office, was when he welcomed the hostages back from Tehran on the south lawn of the White House, gave a little speech, and he promised swift and effective retribution against terrorists who attacked Americans. It was a promise that all of the officials who knew anything about terrorism who were standing around were horrified by. They all said, why is he saying this? He's never going to be able to keep that promise. You can't find him. I mean, there are a bazillion reasons that it was a dumb thing to say. And so Dave Martin and I went back and did the logical thing that reporters do. We tried to figure out, all right, where did this one come from? This rhetoric that elevated the issue to such a level, just as you're talking about in your question. And what we discovered was that the line was written by a guy named Ken Edelman, who later went on to become the head of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. And we went to Ken, who is a very forthright, sort of outspoken sort of fellow, and we said, Ken, there are a lot of people who knew a lot about terrorism who didn't think this was the smartest thing to have the president say. Why did you write this into his script? And Ken said, well, it just sounded good. And those are his exact words, quoted in the book on the record. It just sounded good. So you had people who, I think, understood the premise of your question, that the way to look different from Jimmy Carter was to sound tough, and didn't know beans about the issue. So they made up things for the president to say that sounded good and turned out to be, disastrous.
And do you see that as a deception of the American people?
No, I don't think it's a deception. I think these guys deceived themselves. I mean, I don't think they sat there and said, we'll never be able to keep this promise. I think you give them too much credit if you believe that.
And what is your reaction to the Northern Ireland situation and the South Africa situation?
Well, in both those cases, and a third one that you didn't mention, but which I'll throw into the pot, and that's Israel's attempts to deal with the Palestinian Intifada, the uprising, I've never seen any evidence that you can literally stamp out terrorism by repressive measures. In fact, what you often wind up doing is generating sympathy for terrorists among the population who ordinarily won't support them. But if you begin bashing heads indiscriminately, terrorist heads, innocent people's heads, everybody's heads, what you do, I think, is ultimately A, create more terrorists, and B, worse than that, you foster the kind of political climate in which terrorism thrives, the climate in which people don't believe that legitimate grievances will be heard, and they have no choice but to resort to violence. I think those kind of tactics are counterproductive.
Does your book go on about what a responsible leader, what would he be saying to the American people? I mean, how would he be handling terrorism and getting the American people to understand the complexity of it?
Yeah, well, we do. And again, the conclusion we were drawn to at the end of the book is that, by and large, the right way to deal with terrorism is as a criminal problem. Is to, first of all, to separate acts of terrorism from the supposed motives for them. To say that, if you have a legitimate political grievance, whatever it may be, and many of these people do, the Shiites in Lebanon, for example, clearly excluded from the Lebanese political system, excluded from the Lebanese economy, and we go into that. But that doesn't mean it's all right to go blow up the American embassy, or to take an American missionary hostage, or to hold an American journalist hostage for 4 years. You have to separate the crime, I think, from the motive. Secondly, when you begin to deal with terrorism as a criminal problem, it makes it a lot harder for the freelancers of the Ollie North variety to go in and do all sorts of harebrained things. Because if your object is to bring a guy into court and the judge finds out that you did X, Y, and Z bizarre things, he's going to throw the case out. He's going to let the guy go. Say, I'm sorry, you know, you violated this guy's civil rights, etc. So the law imposes a kind of discipline on the process that was sorely lacking in the Ollie North days. And third, I think it puts the problem into perspective, which is what you're talking about. In fact, terrorism is not, at this point, thank God, a threat to the national security of the United States. It's probably not as great a threat to the United States as narcotics trafficking is, for example. The numbers of Americans killed are dwarfed by the numbers of us who kill ourselves on the highway every year. The number of missing children in this country dwarfs the number of hostages in Lebanon, sad to say. And dealing with it as a criminal problem, I think, helps to put it into perspective and helps to prevent both the government and the people from overreacting to it, from doing the kinds of crazy things that the administration did in order to try to keep those excessive rhetorical promises that it made at the beginning. So, I mean, it doesn't sound very satisfying to say, turn it over to the courts, turn it over to the FBI. But the European countries that have been most effective at dealing with terrorism, West Germany and Italy in particular, have dealt with it that way and have been quite successful.
Well, at that, we're going to have to finish. It's a fascinating book. There's certainly much more than we have had the chance to talk about in the book. And so I would encourage people who are interested in this topic to take a look at it. The title of the book, once again, Best Laid Plans, The Inside Story of America's War Against Terrorism, Harper & Row, the publisher, and the author is David C. Martin, who is Pentagon correspondent for CBS News, and our guest this morning, John Walcott, who is security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Mr. Walcott, thanks very much for spending the time with us.
My pleasure, David.